Mike.
Here we are. Hey, Josh, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm just fine. This is yet another long series of conversations that we've had over the years. Not quite like this.
Last time was probably in, was it in Baghdad or coming out of Baghdad? I think something
we
like that.
We had a nice dinner in Amman, I believe.
Those were the days.
The Four Seasons, and then we've had dinners in Berlin. We had a dinner in Buenos Aires once.
Mike, your memory is better than mine. Your memory's better. I do remember the Buenos Aires dinner. Yes, thanks. Jarring my memory.
I thought you might have repressed some of those memories in those days. Anyway, I think we should probably let everyone know that we are longtime Newsweek colleagues.
Yes,
you left about a year ago,
and I'm still basically doing. Sorry, Mike.
Yep.
Onto more unpredictable terrain, I guess. That of the freelance author, magazine writer. But I have been
always been somewhat unpredictable.
It's a different kind of game. I'm probably not as wired into the daily and weekly news thing that you are, but I'm getting around quite a bit. I'm on my way to Nigeria tomorrow morning, in fact. Down to the Niger Delta, a place I've wanted to go for quite a while. And you just got back, I gather, from Tehran. I've been reading some of your stuff on the web. Quite an interesting piece you did about the mullahs and the sort of the mood of the street in Tehran, which I thought was
captured
things quite nicely. Yeah,
we can talk about that. I would like to run through some of the really interesting stuff you've been working on freelance-wise. But I will just say on a final note, about our past intertwined histories, that we do miss the classic Josh Hammer story, which there are many, many different versions of the classic Josh Hammer story. But
are you talking about stories about me, Mike, or by me?
No. The classic Josh Hammer product.
Because there are both.
Classic Josh Hammer product was me when I was foreign editor in 2001.
Screaming at me in Peshawar, I remember.
Huh?
Yeah. Screaming at me on my cell phone in Peshawar, Pakistan. Yes.
In the middle of the morning meeting, I'll never forget this, in New York on Tuesday, which is the meeting when we decide what the magazine's going to look like the following week. To get the editor's secretary, Mark Whitaker's secretary, running in saying, "Josh Hammer's on the phone. He's getting shelled in the hills of Macedonia."
Yes, back in the days when the Balkans was actually on the map.
People cared. Yeah. You were under a truck, if I recall.
That was one of about five incidents that in the course of my Newsweek.
You always managed to get yourself shelled and.
Yeah.
More important,
yeah.
You managed to get yourself out.
But I don't do that sort of thing anymore. Really, I'd say May 2004 was sort of the turning point. The 9 hours in captivity in Fallujah was kind of a watershed moment for me.
I'm glad to hear that.
You are still getting around to some pretty nasty places. I don't know if Tehran would qualify as nasty.
No, actually, sure. Tehran would not.
Yeah.
Qualify,
I've never been to Iran. Yeah. So.
Well, it just shows you the gulf of misunderstanding. I mean, so many people think of Iran. And when I wrote my piece for Newsweek, I actually said I too am one of those in a time warp from 1979, flying in there and thinking, that. Before long, I'm going to get a bunch of wild-eyed lunatics ranting at me and possibly taking me hostage, or at the very least, spitting in my face for being a representative of the great Satan. And what I found was, that Iran had already moved a generation beyond that and is actually quite a thriving, bustling place in many respects, post-ideological, even though mullah control is still there. It's just this sort of umbrella way above society that does interfere, that prevents, truly free politics from occurring, but nonetheless, within that the context of that umbrella, it is actually a real democracy in many respects. I will say, in 10 days reporting from Tehran, I I had far fewer background and off-the-record conversations with people, and that includes everyone from officials of the regime to outsiders to reformists, than I have here in Washington talking to people about the Bush administration. I mean, people, in some respects, were freer to use their names in dissenting about Ahmadinejad and his policies than you hear people doing here about Bush. So it is not the sort of monolithic terrorist state that we all read about. And, you know, I think one of the more distressing things I heard Condoleezza Rice say in the last few weeks was when she admitted that they basically have no senior-level Farsi speakers at all in the State Department. I mean, a whole generation has gone by without developing that expertise because we haven't had diplomatic relations with them, apparently. So
I don't think we're doing all that much better in the Arabic, although you probably, since you're much more into this covering, you've covered the State Department quite exhaustively over the last few years. Have we made any more? I mean, I assume we've made more progress over the last 5 years, but from what I've heard, not a lot.
Well, anyone who's any good is thereby automatically suspected of terrorist ties because they're too smart or they're too hooked in or whatever.
Right. What is the take on? I mean, you talk to a lot of young people there, people across the spectrum. What is the take on Ahmadinejad generally? Is he admired for his anti-American stance? How do people perceive?
Well, he's clearly developed a populist base. You know, he goes out to the provinces, to the smaller towns. He brings an entourage with him. If someone's door is creaky, or if the local school needs some new desks or a cleaning or whatever, he'll do it right on the spot. It's a very savvy form of demagoguery, if you will. So he has that base. But I will say, I mean, I spent most of my time in Tehran, not all of it. I will say that among the elites, among the intelligentsia of the regime and outside the regime, he's really unpopular. And in an interesting way, it's not so much because of what he's done abroad, although many of the smarter Iranian officials and ex-officials I talked to understand how badly he's isolated the country, really unnecessarily, because of his outrageous comments on the Holocaust in Israel. But the reason why he's really unhappy is because he's mismanaged the economy. He's helped to drive up the inflation rate by artificially suppressing interest rates. Again, a populist move. He's kind of shifted things back to a command economy after a generation in which the Iranians were moving much more toward a free market economy.
Interesting. It's starting to sound a little bit like Hugo Chavez East to me. I've just spent a bit of time over in Venezuela, but in Bolivia, where you have Morales as a sort of Chavez light. But this is, an oil-based economy with a demagogue preaching to the – he was hugely popular among the masses and somewhat loathed by the elites, yeah?
Yeah, and it's interesting. Actually, there are a number of sort of Bush-Ahmadinejad jokes. One newspaper editor I interviewed actually said, you Americans, for you, Bush is your Ahmadinejad. Because they, the Iranians, who don't like Ahmadinejad, see them as of the same ilk, populists, crudely spoken, you often using language unbecoming of a national leader, which is how they see Ahmadinejad, very cynically playing to their narrow political bases, in Bush's case, the religious conservatives, in Ahmadinejad's case, the religious conservatives, and not really caring very much what the rest of the world thinks of them, So there are actually jokes going around town about that.
Makes you think the two guys should get together and Bush could look into his eyes and see a soulmate, So why isn't it happening?
You could almost get there, but it's not going to happen with this administration because they abhor this regime. There's the Israel lobby problem, and they simply I don't think they're going to get that far. Although I have to say, having covered Condi Rice and the State Department and what they've been up to, they are edging closer and closer to these talks. These Ryan Crocker talks going on in Baghdad now with the Iranian ambassador. Were a very significant breakthrough that the Iranians themselves actually put a lot of stock in. I talked to a couple of Iranian officials, including Mohsen Rezai, the Secretary of the Expediency Council, which is a very powerful body in the politics of Iran, who actually said to me, well, this finally proves that they don't want to change the regime, they, the Bushis, because they've opened up these talks. So it's not without hope, but I think probably the best-case scenario is that we get through the next 18 months or so without a war. Yeah. Bush leaves. Perhaps Ahmadinejad is defeated in their 2009 election, and we get two new leaders who can start afresh. So, Josh, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you've been up to? You're heading off to Nigeria.
You know, I'm doing sort of different kind of stuff than I. It's really a different approach to this game than I'm used to, and I'm sort of slowly getting into the rhythms. I mean, I'm just to give you the rundown of the last few months. I mean, I'm writing a lot for a lot of monthly, so there's a whole different pace involved. I went to Pakistan in earlier this year. Spent about 3 weeks there doing a big piece for the Atlantic Monthly on Musharraf, and I don't really want to get into too much detail about it, but it was a story that unfortunately one finds working for monthlies, especially when you're dealing with a volatile place like Pakistan, that often the story kind of runs away from you. No sooner had I returned to, actually then living in South Africa, gotten home when, you know, you had this major crisis, which, you know, you could sort of feel the democratic crisis in the beginning of all Musharraf's woes. I mean, the peace was sort of predicated on the notion of what happens after Musharraf.
Yeah.
And in January, you know, it was a highly hypothetical thing. I mean, sitting around trying to make this somehow relevant was a little difficult because it really didn't look like. I talked to Ryan Crocker, who you just mentioned, who was then, as you know, U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, who was basically told me that the United States, in fact, sees a military ruler as the best solution for Pakistan at the time, as the best solution for, not for Pakistan, but for American interests. And, of course, our relationship with Pakistan is predicated on what's good for us, not necessarily what's good for Pakistan. So at that time, it was clearly, you know, a very beneficial relationship. The U.S. was smiling on him, and it looked like he was destined to stay in power for, you know, for longer than Zia, who lasted, I think, 11 years before he was killed. Well, 2 months or a month and a half after getting back home, all hell broke loose in Pakistan. And now I think that really the whole idea of what comes after Musharraf has taken on a lot more relevance, and one can really see. I mean, Carlotta Gall has been doing some interesting reporting in the Times talking about the turnaround in the military. I mean, Musharraf's basic hold on power has always been predicated on or based on his support by the Pakistani military and his support by the United States. I would say that he probably still enjoys a certain amount of support in the United States, but the military is starting to waver now. So it's quite interesting what's happening there. I don't think it's really become a focus yet. It hasn't really hit this sort of, you know, the alarm bells aren't going off about the fate of Pakistan at this point. But I would guess that within the next, well, you have an election coming up in the fall, and or winter, and I would guess that's going to be a rather big deal.
Now, has he basically? Do you think that Musharraf has created a poison pill politics in Pakistan? Well, look at that alliteration, pretty good, huh? Poison pill politics in Pakistan, by which I mean rig the system so that if he goes, then you get a rising up of religious parties and candidates in a way you wouldn't have had in the past. I mean, Pakistanis used to point very proudly to the fact that, you know, religious parties only got a very, very small portion of the vote. But during Musharraf's term, you know, he's obviously basically banned the main democratic alternatives to him from taking part in the politics. Meanwhile, he seems to have built up this coalition of religious parties.
Well, yeah, and he's also, of course, got alliances. I mean, he's got alliances in a couple of states, with certainly in Baluchistan, along the border with a religious government. The ruling party actually rules in a coalition with the MMA, the religious parties there.
Right.
So it's an interesting question. I mean, it seems like how much of this is sort of stage managed by Musharraf to create the impression that there is this Islamic Frankenstein's monster that is capable of taking over the country. You know, how much of it is stage managed and just is just not based on, is based on perception, image that Musharraf has created, you know, and how much of it is actually something that Musharraf has inadvertently created. It's hard to say. I mean, my feelings from talking to people were that the Islamic parties definitely have gained in power throughout the country over the last 7 years, but that they could never win an election at this point. Now, that's not to say that people are saying, on the other hand, that, you know, should this election be rigged, it could create, you know, such a sense of demoralization and a feeling of anger at the military and hopelessness about the civilian parties. Well, where do you turn? Where did Algerians turn? You turn to the Islamic parties, you know. So it's a scenario. It doesn't seem like it's a likely scenario, but it's out there. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. It's interesting. What do you make of the extent to which elements within the government, the ISI, or the military are once again supporting the Taliban?
Yeah, I think that the I think that that's, when you say once again, I don't think it ever really stopped. It seems like it's been going on for ages. I mean, since 2001, I think there have always been elements of the ISI and the army that never really accepted this reversal of policy that Musharraf forced on the country,
right.
Which really did come out of left field. I mean, Musharraf himself, as we all know, was one of the most diehard Pakistani nationalists and supporters of the Taliban, although it was for practical reasons and not ideological ones. So, but
so
I don't think there's been any deviation in policy. I think there's a lot of mischief going on. Interestingly enough, I was recently in Kashmir. I went to India. I went down for Smithsonian. I went down the Ganges River to do an environmental story. But I took a couple of days at the end of the trip and went up again for the Atlantic. I went up to Kashmir to find out what exactly was happening up there. I talked to a lot of people. People in Indian Kashmir. One good old friend of mine, close friend, very savvy journalist, been there for years, said to me, "Musharraf is our messiah." He said, which is not a view that you find pretty much anywhere else, including the United States State Department these days. But they love him in Kashmir. He has really done an amazing job. I mean, since 2005, they have really moved against the militants. They've pretty much closed the border, something like 90% drop-off in the number of militants who have come across from 2005 to 2007. Yeah. It's a different place. I was there in 2001 when it was Taliban, Al-Qaeda, headquarters. It was a fervent, dangerous place. You go there now, tourists, Indian for the most part, but, you know, 100,000, 200,000 tourists expected this summer.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. And most people I talk to really do lay that at Musharraf's feet. He really did succeed in squeezing out the ISI there. So on the one hand, at the Indian border, you've got this quite a different situation going on than you have in Afghanistan. It's striking.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the general perception among defense and intelligence experts, you know, here in Washington is that, there's an enormous amount of help that Musharraf and his regime and leading members of the military and the ISI still give to the U.S. I mean, there's, you know, scores of FBI and CIA officials in Pakistan that never get talked about. And I guess the point is that, you know, there's a lot of help that he gives out of the public eye because, you know, obviously he's got to worry about the extent to which he's seen as helping the Americans against the Islamists, but that's why he continues to be, quote-unquote, our guy there.
And of course there's just a lot of fear about whether the rest of the military is marching to a different drum than
Musharraf. You see some more disaffection there.
Put all my cards on the table here. The story is still sort of, you know, waiting for its slot. But I would say that there's definitely let me just say this. I think that Musharraf has been very careful about who he's brought up to the top levels of the Pakistani military. He's really micromanaged that aspect of the government. But I think when you get down to the lower levels, the lower ranking officers, the guys in the field, it's quite a different story. And I think that, you know, those are the people that you really, first of all, those are the people on the ground. Those are the people on the border. They're the ones who are waging war against the Taliban. Mm-hmm. And they're also the future, if in fact the army is going to keep running the show in one fashion or another. Those are the guys you've got to look at, you know, the colonel, the majors, the captains, the ones who are at some 5-10 years from now going to be running Pakistan. So anyway, we should not belabor Pakistan, although it is a pretty, you know, intriguing.
It'll
place.
Still it's be there with the same issues the next time we do this or someone else does. So maybe you're right about that. So, you know, here I am. I'm speaking to you from inside the bubble of Washington. And it truly
I'm inside the bubble of my freelance office on the attic of my my house. So you're probably, you know,
are
I'm
you
not
still
exactly
in East Berlin?
Turned into the pulse. No. We're out in the Green West. We're out in Wannsee, which may ring a bell.
I was just there, you know.
Wannsee. Were you really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I passed through with Condi Rice several weeks ago, beginning of June. We were in Potsdam for the G8. Ministerial when there was quite an interesting run-in between Condi and Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, over the missile defense system. And, you know, I wrote a piece saying, boy, this is almost like Potsdam 60 years ago when there was all this happy talk, but meanwhile the Cold War was starting, you know.
Right.
I think things have calmed down a bit since then.
They seem to have.
Well, Putin's in Kennebunkport.
Putin in
right
Kennebunkport, yes.
But, you know, the Russians are certainly playing their own game, and it's a,
I don't know. Putin's popularity is astonishing. I was watching Jim Clancy and the crew are doing, I don't know if domestic CNN is doing what international is doing, but they had a whole week in Russia, a country that I really don't know. But I was just amazed at the popularity of Putin. I mean, he was just Clancy had assembled a group of young people, and it was this kind of universal satisfaction with the guy. I guess things like journalist murders and murky KGB activity and all of that stuff. Just. People just don't seem to care about it very much.
Well, it's the U.S. officials I talked to here say it's a, you know, it's actually a new kind of political form that's evolving that most resembles perhaps 1930s fascism, except they don't really want to call it that because that has so much baggage to it. But it's a corporatist type state. He's put his KGB pals in charge of the state, you know, state energy companies, other companies. If you recall, that's what fascism was. Nominal, you know, some nominal democracy is retained, but with increasing control from the Kremlin. And, you know, I guess on the theory that people get the kind of government they deserve, maybe that's what the Russians really want.
So the outrage that we saw over the, you know, this, the, over the Poloskaya murder, I believe it's Poloskaya, right?
Poloskaya, yeah.
I mean, that the outpouring in the streets was really just a handful, I suppose, her colleagues a couple of thousand people. But I don't know how tuned in you are to the pulse of Russia. Have you traveled there with Condi? Have you talked to people on the streets of Russia? Do these kind of incidents register with people? Is there just kind of a shrug of the shoulders and that, you know, Putin has made as
they don't. These are not mass demonstrations of the kind, the various color.
It's something that we in the States, we members of the Fourth Estate here, find so outrageous and yet kind of greeted with apathy and a shrug of the shoulders.
A year or so ago, when Putin, you know, seized control of the state governorships, and yet another anti-democratic move, we did a story on the only lonely protest that was conducted. At the time, which was by the old Communist Party against the anti-democratic move. So, you're right. He's hugely popular, and another worrisome sign there. And we're just, you know, waiting for the next, you know, Russo-German anti-aggression pact. Wait for that to happen. So, anyway, on other fronts, well, I was just saying, I'm here in the Washington bubble, and, you know, you get around more than anyone I know. I mean, I think you probably have been to more places than any correspondent I know. And I know a lot of the places you've been because we've communicated from there when I was an editor or writer in New York or Washington. What is, you know, just give me some sense of, let's give Washington viewers a little reality check on how Bush and the Americans are viewed in most of the places. Is there any place apart from Albania
I'll tell you it's interesting about Albania. There's a phenomenon here that I think
I knew you knew about Albania.
Well, I haven't been there lately. I mean, I was there in Kosovo time. I think you must have passed through during that period, right? Did you?
I kind of brushed by the border.
Tirana?
I brushed by the border.
Interesting place, but it's not. It's an Eastern European phenomenon. I'll tell you. I have when I was living down in Cape Town until last March. Some of our closest friends that our kids went to school together was a Romanian couple. Who had been there for the downfall of Ceausescu, lived through the revolution there, and they were both dentist doctors, had emigrated to South Africa, had lived there for about 10 years or so. They were, without a doubt, the most diehard supporters of George Bush that I have ever encountered. And there is this phenomenon. It's interesting. You have Enver Hoxha in Albania. You have Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania. These products of a totalitarian, a twisted, you know, psychotic, sadistic totalitarian society. Really, really, those two are probably the worst. I think Albania and they both ended. Well, I guess Romania, of course, the revolution was a violent one. Albania was less sort of violent than just sort of prolonged anarchy. But you know, it just shows you the kind of pernicious effects of those years. But those people, I'm drifting away from my theme, but this couple saw these very, and what was going on here was very clear. There was an intense parallel that they drew between Saddam Hussein and Ceausescu, and they were absolute supporters all the way down the line. Bush could do no wrong in their eyes. Yeah. And we used to have these endless conversations, endless arguments about it into the night that just ended up going nowhere. They just could not be persuaded. This was in their view, this was an absolutely heroic action that very few they saw it as an act of tremendous courage, moral decency, and Bush in their eyes was a hero. Very much so as you saw the reception in Albania. So it's interesting. I mean, there's a paradigm here, you know. I think that this is something that you
see
throughout
the Albanian paradigm,
throughout the ex former Iron Curtain paradigm. Call it what you want. The Poles love him too. Although I think the Poles are starting to temper themselves a bit. But the Eastern Europeans still see. I think if there's one corner of the planet that remains very much pro Bush, and again, lately I haven't been to Eastern Europe, I've been to Sarajevo fairly recently, where I think that Sarajevo is still a place that it wasn't so much Bush, it's just a very pro-American place. I mean, they view this as America. America essentially finally ended the war there, so it doesn't matter if Bush
and yet we don't get
whoever,
Americans don't
American
get much
thing.
Credit among in the Muslim world in general for having.
No, it's probably
stuck
one of the few Muslim countries, that in Albania, where there is a residue of great support for America. So, but you know, I mean, I spend much of my time traveling in South Asia and Africa and places that I think the loathing of George Bush is probably a bit less intense in Africa. But certainly, it's probably this is where I am right now. This is probably one of the great bastions of anti-Bush sentiment.
Yeah, I get the sense in talking with, other governments, officials, everyone is just basically waiting for the 18 months to be up.
Yeah, and there's a tremendous amount of interest.
Disastrous presidency to be over.
Yeah.
And then they can start picking themselves up out of the rubble. I mean, they're already, you know, and Bush, of course, would already be entering a lame duck phase, even the best of times.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, everyone understands that, you know, he's sort of really living in his own bubble and
right.
a little bit out of touch with reality.
But it doesn't. It does look like somebody is some Democratic president is going to have to pick up. And I it looks to me, it feels to me. You live in the States, but it just feels to me like it's this is a Democrat. Democrats would have to be quite inept, and they have been.
Yeah, it's theirs to lose.
To lose
it's
this.
Hillary's to lose.
But
actually,
it's Hillary's to lose. But they're still going to be left with this tremendous mess to clean up. And because I believe it feels to me like the policy now is just simply run out the clock. Although I'm curious to see how in Iraq, of course, I'm talking about how it is going to, what happens when this September day of reckoning comes around.
Yeah.
Where are things going to stand at that point? Because we've been
I don't think there's going to be a day of reckoning. I think that's really a red herring, and I've been told by pretty senior officials who oversee the Iraq policy that they don't really expect things to look any better in September, which obviously is getting closer now. This is early July, than they are now. There were always horribly unrealistic expectations raised by the Bush people, by Petraeus, about the surge and how long it would take. Petraeus finally came clean a couple weeks ago and, you know, and said, look, counterinsurgencies take like 10 years to conduct and to win. And, you know, it was always absurd to think that in 6 months or 8 months you're going to get some sort of a dramatic turnaround, which obviously you're not getting at all. And you know, not, there's all these questions about the effectiveness and basic competence of the Maliki government. So,
yeah.
So I don't, you know, I don't expect anything to change there, and it's a virtually intractable situation. I don't know about you, but I've basically decided I'm not going back to Iraq. I've been there a total of three times for a month each, and the last time I was there, I actually felt a little guilty about being there. I'm the father of two sons, you know, and I said, "What, you know, this is just crazy. This is just the worst possible."
Were you embedded, Mike, or what?
I did an embed with some MPs going out on patrol, and I went up to Balad Air Base and did a story out of there on how we were, you know, sort of permanently putting down roots.
Yeah, the permanent basis thing. I saw that.
But I spent a lot of time.
And when was that?
That was a year ago, April.
I was there basically a month after you.
Okay.
My last trip was in May 2006. I went down with the British in Basra. Spent a few days there.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of amazed that I actually got up the nerve to go back there after my May 2004 experience, because I really did think that I was in Daniel Pearl territory there.
Yeah, you were very dangerously close to Daniel Pearl territory from
I was.
From what I understand.
Nick Berg, as I pointed out a few times, was in the same town and possibly the same block, you know, while we were in captivity. So, but somehow it took me about a year and a half to summon up the nerve. I went back in December, even went back to Fallujah. Mm-hmm. In the company of a John McCain type convoy of Marines surrounding me as I went in to watch the elections back in December 2005, I believe.
Yeah.
Then I went back again in May. But I do want to go back because I would on the one hand I would like to be able to read the mood of the American soldiers there and just see what exactly is happening on the ground. But I do feel at this point that, you know, let others do it. Let others. Let younger people who don't have kids.
Right.
I just think it's too big a risk.
I mean, the worst part of it for me psychologically was that I, particularly when I went there last time, I really didn't want to take a lot of risks. But, you know, if you sit there in the green zone, you feel guilty journalistically.
Of course.
You know,
what
am I doing here? I could be.
Although these days, you know.
Yeah, well, these days the green zone is more dangerous.
Mortars falling in the green zone, exactly.
Yeah, actually, one.
No, I mean, you can do a piece on Crocker, and you could probably follow around Petraeus and do those kinds of stories. But essentially,
you've got to get out there, and
of course you do.
Once you get out there, then it becomes too risky for my taste, at least at this point. But I don't know. What's your take? I mean, I think that it's
no. My take all along is as I was right after Petraeus took this job. I had spent some time with Petraeus, as probably every journalist in Iraq has been charmed by Petraeus at one point or other, gotten his little 10th Mountain Division, or what is it? What was not 10th Mountain Division? Sorry, what was his?
He was the 101st.
101st Airborne.
I was with him when he was
his little coin, you know, back up in Mosul that he handed out to everybody who came through. I mean, Petraeus was just an incredibly warm, open, accessible, impressive guy, you know. And when he – and then I followed him again when he came back to try to became – remember Newsweek ran a cover, I believe, which I initiated the reporting on, and Rod Norland followed up about can this man save Iraq? I believe this
was almost cost him his career, by the way.
Did it? Well, I'm just wondering, is this guy – I'd like to hear about that. But, I mean, now this guy's come in again as our, you know, our man in Iraq. And, I mean, I think – again, I think Petraeus is a hugely impressive guy. But, you know, what happened with that Iraqi security force that he was supposed to take over and transform? And what happened with this surge that he was promising would turn things around? See, am I right that he was – maybe that's going a little bit too far. There was a bit of caution.
He was, no question.
I mean, is this a guy who's failing upwards, or is he just, is he the best we've got in a situation that just cannot be fixed, or can one lay any of the blame on this at Petraeus' doorstep? I don't know. I mean,
can make the argument, you know, that he was named skipper.
Anybody fixed it. Why does he go into
the skipper of the Titanic after the iceberg? You know,
true.
And you know, it was unsalvageable. You know, what we do know is that Petraeus was coming in to essentially reverse on Bush's orders the policy of the previous couple of years under General George Casey, which was Iraqification, which was withdrawal into the big super bases like Balad. And let the so-called Iraqi security forces that were supposed to be ready handle it. And by the fall, it became clear that that was just not going to work. The Iraqi security forces were not ready. The Maliki government seemed to be teetering, and they did basically a 180, you know, which is Bush saying, okay, we've got to go, and we Americans are going to be doing the frontline patrolling.
But the American forces were just too small to do it, correct?
And still are.
They're
still playing whack-a-mole.
The idea that you could send this small force in to at this late point in the game always struck me as illogical. And I was just amazed that Petraeus was willing to take on that responsibility and that leadership at possibly the risk to his own reputation and career. So I don't know. Is he going to come out of this unscathed? How do you assess?
I don't think anyone
comes
out of it unscathed. No. But you know, he's got his fourth star, and he's definitely one of the Army's best and brightest. You know, Ryan Crocker's one of the diplomatic services best and brightest.
Right.
So there's a sense that these guys can't do anything with it. You know, no one can.
Right.
But I do think that they're going to, you know, get back to Baker Hamilton increasingly. There aren't any coherent plans. I mean, I've been writing about this for some time now, the whole idea that there's a coherent strategy for getting us to, like, South Korea, as Bush alluded to a few weeks ago, or back to Baker Hamilton is just nonsense. They're not really moving in that direction. They just seem to be drifting sideways. So I think that they're going to gradually ratchet down the force, but probably not until sometime well into 2008.
And how low do you think it's going to go? What do you predict will be the size of the force?
Well, the original plan
under
Baker Hamilton was to have something like 50,000 to 60,000 combat troops with maybe 30,000 in support. And I think that that's where they're heading back to that idea. Where you have rapid reaction forces, you have special forces going after al-Qaeda, but you're not doing the sort of frontline patrolling that's happening right now.
The problem
with that scenario, and one of the reasons that Bush did the surge in the first place, is they came to realize that, al-Qaeda was not a steady state. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was not a steady state. You had a situation where if you let the Shiite militias go after Sunnis, then the Sunni population was going to continue to support al-Qaeda, and we couldn't just let that go. You know, we couldn't just sort of hunker down on our big bases and let that situation emerge, because then you're generating roots for al-Qaeda. So that's one of the reasons they decided to go after it aggressively. But, there are some hopeful signs in Anbar province where, you know, some of the Sunni tribals...
Some of these sheikhs have turned around.
Doing their own policing against al-Qaeda. The bottom line is this is a long-term operation. Petraeus and the Bush people were really not forthright about that at the very beginning. They needed to say, look, we're doing a 180 on the previous plan. We're going to be in there 10 years. That's how long it's going to take, you know, and they just couldn't bring themselves to do it because it was so politically toxic to say so.
Right.
So
right.
Now they're paying the piper because there's all this disillusionment about, oh, the surge didn't work, you know.
Right.
When any military expert you talk to, counterinsurgency expert, said the surge was always going to take a long, long time. Right. So, it's a mess. it's about as close to being an intractable quagmire as I've ever seen in my lifetime, and the only hope
would you say that is it your sense there that it's bottomed out, or it's reached
a
level of hideous violence, and yet since the surge began it doesn't seem to have accelerated. Now, you know, granted, 50, 75 people dead violently a day is not something to be sanguine about, but it hasn't worsened. I think there is a kind of consensus that it's reached a civil war state, but how do you quantify it? Where is it?
Well, I mean, the scary thing is psychologically, and there's been some reporting about this. There was a story in the New York Times, I think, a few weeks ago, that this sense that psychologically the Shiites and Sunnis have really just begun to fight. You got a lot of years of pent up frustration. Obviously, Sunnis feeling
oppressed.
You see
that with the Balkans. What finally turned around the Balkans was exhaustion after, but how many? 200,000, 300,000 dead. Yeah.
Right. And I think that state of exhaustion, they're not even close to that. And it's also the tragedy of Afghanistan, to my view. I mean, I think one of the strategic tragedies, catastrophes, is how little attention was paid to Afghanistan as we shifted so quickly to Iraq, because I think the Afghans were exhausted. I think they were in that exhausted state in 2001, after 23 years of civil war, and had we exploited that situation and really moved in with some resources and attention, we could have rescued that situation. By contrast, the Iraqis, had their passions were so tamped down by Saddam for so many decades that now they're really getting released. And I just think it's going to go on and on and on for several years.
One has to see a feeling, certainly in Afghanistan, of a kind of a steady creeping upward. Nothing really dramatic, but definitely the suicide bombings are increasing. The attacks seem to be growing. You've had several quite nasty attacks in Kabul the last couple of months, which was at some fair moving along. I was in Kabul most recently in March, and there was a lot of optimism there. A feeling that maybe down in the south, the rest of the country. Southeastern Afghanistan is highly unstable, but we're on a track here. We're developing. I guess it's a bit less secure now. There have been a couple of major attacks in there. And Karzai and his government had gone to great efforts to keep Kabul an island of security. So when the attacks in Kabul, you have things to worry about.
Now we got suicide car bombs having been exported to Kabul, to Afghanistan, and apparently now to Glasgow, Scotland. What's next? IEDs in the streets of Manhattan? Become a giant terror factory. Those failed efforts. So
it's a pretty grim picture all around, as usual, I suppose.
Yeah, and I know that, you're usually such a jolly guy, Josh, and I am too, but do we have any positive words with which to leave
Well, I'm looking forward to I'm looking forward to Acadia National Park. How about that? I don't think I'll be
Working
any IEDs there in July. Yes, so that's
but watch out for falling rocks. Yeah.
Right. What about you, Mike? What are your
that was
plans?
My last brush with danger, by the way. A large falling boulder in the Alborz Mountains of Iran, heading toward the Caspian Sea. Landed on the roof of our car and actually penetrated the metal. So
yes, did you see any?
Beware
any,
of that.
Any, okay, I'll keep that in mind. Any members of the Mahdi Army up there pushing, pushing them down? And
we were not able to track them down. But
so we've done 45 minutes. This has been good. This has been good.
All right. Well, I wish we had some thematic wrapping up to do. I guess.
I'm going to leave it to our fearless media mogul Bob Wright to probably interject himself maybe at some point, and I don't know, and offer some pearls of wisdom. I don't know if
he's
that's technologically feasible or not, but I think we should end it here. And it's been great talking to you, and we will
good talking to you, Josh.
If we're ever invited back, I look forward to it, Mike.
All right, man. Have good luck in Nigeria.
All right, take care, man. Bye bye.
Take care.